December 3rd, 2011. It's a Watt from Pedro show. What from Pedro Show? Sunny Saturday morning here in my town. But I'm going to be flying in a few hours up to SF. I was supposed to do the show yesterday. Well, there was a lot of supposed to's. We're going to have guest Nicole Panner. But that's going to be next week because of timing misschedules on that. That's why Brother Matt's not with me either. He was, I was supposed to be with him yesterday, but he got to go to a Pirates baseball game, you know, which is San Pedro Pirates, not Pittsburgh. And so, comedy errors, I guess, with the timing thing. So, Watt is man alone here. I should tell you that we started off today's show with Blues to Elvin from John Coltrane, which is very significant because an hour or two of the show today, we're going to have a Q&A from Elvin like 10 years ago in Ravenna, Italy, that Fratello Andrea from El Sogno di Maionio trio with Stefano Pellia share. Turned me on to this. He went to this workshop that Elvin had, so we'd be playing that. And then we heard Affecta by Sawako. I wanted to do a show, and I got a little time, so why not? It'll be mostly music, not a lot of spiel, because man alone seems to stumble over his words and stumble bum. Not a very together sometimes in my monologue mode. Although I get that way sometimes trying to do dialogue. I gotta work on that. I'm gonna play for you something now. This band opened up for me and my missing men in Glasgow October. Great band called Gummy Stumps from that town.
Yo! Spiders. This is called spiders, about spiders.
The pink cow.
Spiders. As a child, my mother would summon me whenever there was a spider in the bathroom. It was my duty to kill it with a rolled up copy of Woman's Day in my right hand. My sister standing in the hallway, peering over my shoulder, with my mother screaming as my first attack didn't hit. The little gray monster scurried down the wall, past a mirror, where my killer reflection reflected in my killer face. Hopping onto the soap dish, my father's razor, and finally finding safety on my mother's toothbrush, which sent her into higher hysterics than she was already at, and swag! Dead spider on my mother's brand new, soft bristle, flex handle, stocking stuffer toothbrush. And I remember the joy of picking up the dead spider by one of its remaining legs and chasing my sisters around the room, threatening to make them eat it. As my mother chased me from room to room, trying to hit the dead spider out of my hand with a dirty green dust broom. How quickly the tables could turn. The savior is sent away. The angels have fallen from the sky to be treated like a degenerate leper, peeping Tom pushed back down into the alley below. And I always regretted killing those spiders. As I later learned from Mr. Giordano, that spiders are our friends. Unless, of course, you're camping in the Mojave Desert and wake up with one on your forehead. Otherwise, the arachnid family is constantly catching mosquitoes, stopping flies from flying, keeping our precious blue veins and our very own precious hearts, and reminding us to redecorate every once in a while. How hard can it be to put up some curtains, paint the kitchen, hang some pictures, when the spider abandons his house and builds a new one without the assistance of thumbs, 2x4, or real estate agent. In my most recent apartment, I see a spider almost every other day. Or maybe it's the same spider moving from one end of my apartment to the other, which wouldn't be tough, as my home is not a house. So no mouse, no mosquito allowed, but spiders are free to spend the night. Spiders, please forgive me for the bloodshed of my youth. I never took any pleasure. Not like the gypsy moths that we used to catch and put in the microwave. Or the frogs that we used to release at the Pear Street intersection, waiting for them to be squashed by couldn't care less Lincoln Town cars.
Yay, 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 yay
Okay, you first heard Walking to Work by the Gummy Stumps. Much thanks to Brother Depp there in Glasgow for flowing that. Kind of hard to find, but that's from their first EP, and Monorail Music in Glasgow there, I know is one connection. I'll be playing more, though, future shows, because I love this band. They're wild. The guitar man played, he had a bass string, too, so he was like that string section, and they had a drummy, and then Colin on the singing there. Great band. Then we heard The Spiders, a poem by Frank Spignese. I think that's how you spell it. Spignese. Hope I didn't fuck it up. I got to meet him in Tokyo. That's where he's been living. And he just put out a new book. Much respect to Mike Kubik there over at Super Deluxe for making the connect. That's a poem of his called The Spiders. It's also in his book. It's called The Great Flood. It's a book of poems from him. And very happening cat. Intense. And what do we say? Plain speaking, we like this, right? Yeah. Mike says he has hopes that Frank does a spiel with me. He's done several interviews with people, Mike told me, and he thought it'd be good if I got in the ring with him. So hopefully that'll happen in the future. Maybe like a Skype thing, huh? Then we heard 1,000 Buddhas of the Pure Land of Bass from Low Frequency. And finally, Horses by Dirty Beaches, which is a great album. Dirty Beaches, Alex, what's the name of the album? Badlands. Yeah. Incredible thing. Got to play with him in Antwerp. And had a good time sharing the stage and getting turned on to his music. Righteous Cat. Thursday was a Stooges gig. Makeup gig. 3 months ago, we were supposed to play in Hollywood at the Palladium. But just before that, we were in Romania for the last of the Europe gigs of the summer. And Ig broke his foot. He broke it in the first song, but kept charging. We did the whole gig. Man, I'd never seen anybody work in so much pain, but Ig, you know, he's determined. He wants to do the gig. Much respect to him. I mean, wild. Maybe I've talked about it on the show, but it was a pretty Olympian effort. But do rigor for Ig, because, yeah, he likes to work the gigs. And come back here, it looked like it healed up good, because he was dancing and twirling and leaping and singing his heart out. He went to the deck a few times, but that's because he goes all out. I'm pretty sure the foot held up good. And we got two more gigs. We're going to make up the San Francisco ones now at the Warfield, Sunday and Tuesday. But, I mean, the sound of the Palladium ain't all that good, you know. But it's better than it was, let's put it that way. I remember when the Minutemen played there with Black Flag and Ramones. Yeah, you could, on the cover of Henry's Getting a Van book, you can see a picture. Speaking of Henry, yeah, I did a dose gig, a benefit. Me and Kay played this thing for clean water in Africa Wednesday, and the MC was Hank. So good to see Henry again. Me and Kay took pictures with him against some wall like they do on a rug, you know. It's a kind of fancy thing. It was kind of trippy. And we did a few tunes. He did a real good intro. Very kind. Hank always is. And they provided us with these tiny little lamps. I think we pushed them a little too hard. Didn't mean to. But it was a good cause. We're glad, me and Kay were both glad we were there. And, yeah, our old buddy Hank to hook up again that way. Much respect. You know, December's always a good time for benefits. Actually, any time of the year is. Getting back to this Hollywood gig with the Stooges, opening band. Well, the first cat's on was Whitey Kirst, who did a lot of years with the Ig. In fact, played a bunch with the man on the drums for these gigs, Larry Mullen, in the 90s. Whitey told me, you know, when he met Larry, he was delivering pizzas or something. And it was Whitey who told Larry about them trying out drummers or something. A show over the summer I did with Larry when he started filling in for Scotty, who's still healing up. I'll be playing with him again next summer, is the news I'm told. And after Whitey, though, and his trio. Anyway, you can go back and listen to Larry's spiel. He has the whole thing there. And interesting about him, he just met his natural ma. He hasn't met her yet in person. That's going to happen after these gigs. He's going to fly to Atlanta. Which is a beautiful thing. He had gotten contact with her over the summer when we were doing gigs together as the Stooges rhythm section. But anyway, opening up after Whitey, so I guess middle band, the Baloney spot was a great band. Speaking of Baloney, Les Butcherettes. At the butcher shop you find Baloney. And man, this Terry tore it up. The band is different than last time I shared stage with them. They had a lady drummer, and Omar was on the bass. And I'm going to play some music now from both Les Butcherettes. And I guess Omar produced this album. It's something from him, too. And some other Sgt. Howe stuff. Let's hear some Tara Melos and some Boris. A lot from Pedro Show.
Shine was it? I guess it disappeared, thanks to you. Why me? I don't know, because you're the one that only mentioned it.
Yeah.
Scott from Pedro Show. You just heard Boris doing Missing Pieces. Head of that was Guy vs. DC Sniper by Tara Melos. I heard Nick and Nathan's going to be at the gig tonight. Tomorrow night in San Francisco. See some Stooges. I better play good, huh? I always got to play good for Stooges. I want to. I try. Before that was Shake is for 8th graders by El Grupo Nuevo de Omar Rodriguez Lopez. So Omar's new band. Man, did I play that one before? I just love the song. So if I did, excuse me. It's a trip. He's a trip. He's a great bass player too. Southpaw. Plays a little Stang we were talking about. And started off with Nico's Smooth Talking Mothers by Les Butcherettes. Much respect, Miss Terry. We're at the end of the first hour of the December 3rd, 2011 Watt for Pedro Show. Hold tight for hour two. December 3rd, 2011. It's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. And now here's a question and answer session during a workshop by Elvin Jones in Ravenna, Italy, March 11th, 2001. This was given to me by El Sonio del Marinaio drummer man Andrea Belfi. He was there for a drum workshop with Brother Elvin. He played with John Coltrane. They say he's part of the classic quartet. Made many, many gigs and recordings with him. And he's just a righteous man. Me and, well, Raymond first took me to see him, then me and him seen him a bunch of times because he lived, ended up living in Nagasaki. And so his first gigs would be on the West Coast. This is starting in the 80s when I got to see him. And I saw him many times with Raymond. And I have no higher respect for anyone on the drums, Mr. Elvin Jones. So here he is.
The next question is, if the drums express and express it completely what you are.
What you have.
In a certain way, yes, that's true. But in other words, everybody is more than an instrument. you are more than your drum. You are more than your piano. Because first of all, you're human. That encompasses a great many things. That means you're. You might be a father, or you're somebody's brother, you're the son of a mother and father, and it's part of the human family, so in that sense, related, because we are all human beings. And, music is simply a part of the expression that as art, painting and literature and of any of the art forms, it's simply a part of what being a human being is all about, and that is simply or in advancing and developing one's intellect to that extent that you can appreciate the different things that you see and that you hear and that you endeavor to study and be part of an orchestra, if you like, or you can be a teach mathematics in a university, or teach physics in nuclear physics or astronomy or whatever you like. I think it's all part of what it is we do. I'm a percussionist. I love music. I suppose that's my challenge. It was not so difficult for me to learn how to play because it's what I always wanted to do. I didn't want to play a piano. I didn't want to play a saxophone. I didn't write anything. I just wanted to play drums. I'm sorry, I've talked too much.
First of all,
I'd like to know what remains after your John Coltrane's experience, of that experience. What remains in your music in terms of inspiration and in terms of finding again new things to do?
And the second thing is not a question, it's just to say your thanks for a great recording. I think it's not well known around. A great recording with Tommy Flanagan you've done, and it's called Overseas. When you played one of the most beautiful brushes I've ever heard.
You know, that was I don't think no one ever really stops, you know, learning. And to me, the greater the experience, the more the possibility for you to learn from that experience. And one of my greatest experiences was with John Coltrane, and so I learned a great deal. And the learning and being able to make a gift of that experience to anyone else is that's what my being able to interpret compositions and to express my interest in music through the instrument that I play, and to be as creative and as informative as possible. And this is all part of a responsibility that one accepts if you have an exceptional gift. I think I was gifted from my family, from God, from wherever, this ability to play this instrument. And so it was freely given to me, and so I feel that I should freely, as often as possible, give as much as I can to anyone else, whoever can hear it. So, and the second part of your statement, question, it wasn't a question, it was a statement. But what I was going to say before, but I think I should have articulated it a little bit better. that recording I made with Tommy Flanagan was made in Sweden, Stockholm, Sweden, in 1957, and that was before I had the opportunity to play with John Coltrane, and I learned a lot of what I was doing, I suppose, at that with brushes was sort of expressing myself as if I were, as I used to see Buddy Rich play fantastic drum solos with brushes. I used to see Joe Jones, you know, who played with Count Basie's band, or Papa Joe Jones. He would play with brushes, he would play anything. And Big Sid Catlett, who was a master, a magician with brushes. And so I tried to, you know, I thought I could do it too. So it was just, I thought that in order to create the kind of a dynamic balance that I felt was necessary with just a piano and a bass. I mean, there was no horns or anything, so really didn't require drumsticks to back up to create the kind of dynamic that was required for that trio. And Tommy Flanagan was such a delicate pianist, you know, he was very, very delicate. And he still is. And so, but that was an incident. I don't know, probably. If I hadn't heard Buddy Rich, or if I hadn't heard Joe Jones, and if I hadn't heard you know, Sonny Greer and Art Blakey and all of these guys, I would never have been able to do that. Because they taught me. You know, I learned from them. It was just a matter of being able to carry on with the lesson that I've learned and apply the knowledge in within my own context. So that's what it's all about. And you blurted it out, but we're aware of his name, so that was another recording that was sort of an accident. The way it happened, we finished that tour with in Sweden, J.J. Johnson and Tommy Flanagan, Bobby Jasper had that band, and we got back to New York and played a few times. I had a fight with J.J. and we so he fired me. I come from New Jersey, a little club out in New Jersey, where I went came back to New York, and I live in the Greenwich Village, you know, Bleecker Street and Thompson. I've been a 6-floor walk up apartment. So I was going in there, and I saw one of my brothers, Tom, who was there. He was there in New York. And he said,
yes, Tom?
Tom Jones, my brother.
Uh-huh.
One of my brothers. I have five brothers.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, he asked me, he said, what's the matter with you? He said, you look funny. I said, come on, let's go out. And so we wanted to walk around in the village and go to a bar and get, you know, drink and have some fun, you know. So he was going to cheer me up. So we started to walk around in the village, and we went from 6th Avenue and got over to 7th Avenue, and I happened to see, we passed this club, the Village Vanguard, and Wilbur Ware was standing outside, and he said, Sonny is waiting for you. I said, how can he be waiting for me? You know, he's a big liar, you know. But he was a lot of fun. He said, I want you to come and sit down there, you know, and play a set with him. He was going to play too. So I said, oh, well, okay. And that's right. My brother said, that's a good idea. We put on him. I said, and he could hear me, but he'd never seen me play. So I said, well, you can listen to me play. I'll sit in with these guys. So that's how it happened. And when we were playing there, because Pete LaRocca was the drummer, you know, and Don Bailey was the bass player from Philadelphia. And
with the trio bass.
Yes. He was with them. That was the trio that Sonny Rollins had. But he wanted Wilbur Ware and I to sit on this particular. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just one tune, but it said we played the whole set. And I looked at Honest, and there was the Blue Note management. They were recording everything. So that's how that record happened to be made. It was a complete coincidence.
Very good.
I guess my question is how you feel about the direction of jazz music today, the direction that it's going, or you know the way things are people are playing today and in today's time, in the sense of in the sense of experimentation. It seems like in the past there was more experimentation in the direction of the music. And I mean, there is now, but it seems it's not supported, I guess, by the public. Maybe it seems like there's more reflection on history, and although history is important in the music, I guess it's the history is building. You know, there's more history or something now than there was. You know, so there's more to learn before you can experiment. But how do you feel about that? The direction of it.
Oh. Well, I can answer that with another example, an example of different time periods.
Right.
For instance, when in 1939. When Dizzy Gillespie was playing with Cab Calloway.
Yeah.
Cab Calloway fired Dizzy because it was not because of he was playing. He played just like he did, the year, the same year he died. He never played any different.
Right, right.
You know, all of that, he made a whole new the industry out of trumpet playing, and that's the way he played. That's all. But he would sit in a section, or in a trumpet section, in anybody's band. He'd play the music, but when it was time for his solo, he would play it like he was.
Yeah.
So he started that, and he fired Dizzy because he was throwing spitballs at his head when he was singing, So that's how he. So anyway, there's a lot of he's a big he liked to play, but the music that he introduced at that time was very. People didn't know what it was. It was very radical. It was completely new, and nobody had any idea of what he was doing. Maybe there were a few people. I suppose Duke Ellington always knew what it was. Roy Eldridge, who was another great trumpet player, they were good friends, and they studied together and they played similar styles.
Right.
And most of the, Billy Eckstein, say, for instance, when he started his big band, and Dizzy was and the music that Dizzy had introduced became the keystone of his orchestrations of all the compositions that they developed. With arrangers like Tad Dameron and people like that who carried it even further into the intellectual and creative, very creative writing part of music notation. And so, but it took COPS 1939.
Yeah, right.
So it took about almost 20 years before anybody even knew what it was.
Yeah.
So it's not a really, that isn't something that you can measure. I think what you measure,
the individual thing,
is what it is. Yeah. Your own, you can tell what you contribute, your contribution.
Right.
Or if you do something, right? Then you say, well, I know I did that. But yeah. You can't tell, you know, it's very difficult to tell. Where did you get that idea?
Yeah.
You must have heard it someplace, or maybe you didn't, you know. And even if you didn't, because the atmosphere that in which you grew up was that. Is what was prevailed at that time, and you had your intellect was sharp enough to respond to that,
yeah.
And that's why you learned. That's how you begin to understand it.
Yeah.
So that's all that really happens now is that the jazz isn't any different now than it was when James P. Johnson was playing,
you know,
it sounds a little different because we're all, you know, it's music is everything develops. You know.
Right.
Musical instruments, you know, drums used to be these drums used to they used to put the tension on these drums with a rope.
Yeah, right,
you ever
right,
see that?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, they like it.
Yeah.
He put tension. That's the way they used to do it with all of them.
Right.
And then so. Yes. That's changing now. It's very high, you know. It's a very high tech operation. It's like building an airplane. Titanium, all of this
yeah,
metal
yeah,
on
yeah.
there. It's
like
titanium,
yeah.
And the wood is, you know, it's a new rim. For instance, there's 15 layers of laminated, very thin lumber. It's as hard as. It's harder than this steel.
Right.
It's better. It's better than that.
Right.
And it doesn't ring. It doesn't give it. You don't get these overtones in the snare drum that you would normally hear with a metal rim.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of improvements being done.
Yeah.
And it's because of the factory of Yamaha built that snare drum for me.
Yeah.
I'm not you here.
Yeah.
So that's all. It's about things like that, and they're very subtle when changes happen. It doesn't happen so. Nothing is already, you know, so dynamic or dramatic. It just happens very gradually.
Right.
Yes. They would love them to play something good. When you
well,
want.
You know, I have to wait till I stop trembling.
Trembling?
Yeah.
What do you mean
trembling? I'm nervous.
Ah, nervous. You're
Yes.
When you was young, you when you have decided to start. Played drum.
When?
Chiesto quando ha deciso di cominciare a suonare. Si è trovato a suonare la batteria quando era giovane. Lui ha detto quando aveva 2 anni.
I thought that Buddy Rich told me he started when he was 3.
Buddy Rich ha cominciato quando aveva 3 anni.
At least, but he was. At least he had a set of drums, you know. And his mother and father, they were in vaudeville theater, you know. So he was performing when he was 3 years old.
Is there any album of the hundreds he played on that you prefer? And if yes, what is it?
It takes me. I'm very shy about my recording.
Un po' si vergogna un po' di parlare della sua registrazione.
Because it takes me a long time to realize that I've done anything of value. I don't like to say. Well, this is great, and this is not. My best recollections are with people that I admire. For instance, there was one when I made my first agriculture. This is the first album I made with Bruno. With a trio with Joe Farrell and Jimmy Garrison. The trio. And I like that because I liked what, you know, this Joe, Giuseppe Dantello. He plays such a master of woodwind and single reed. And he can play anything. He can play, pick up an oboe, bassoon, and, you know, clarinet, you know, saxophones, you know, all the whole range, you know, flutes, piccolos, whatever, you can play anything. And like a master, a masterful kind of performer on any woodwind reed. So I always admire that. I feel proud that Leo, we made this album together, you know, Joe Farrell and Jimmy Garrison and myself. So it's called Putting It Together, and that's on Bruno. So I think I like that one. I like those. I feel as if something was really done. I don't know exactly what. I don't know how much value it is, but to me, it was something that was, I thought it was very beautiful. And, in a way, as a contribution to the musical catalog.
One of the things that made you so great in the musical sound is the sound of the drums. And what is and what was your relationship with the recording of the drums at that time, I mean in the 60s, when, and if you remember any recording that was more in the in your idea of your sound more than others.
Oh, yes, remember, I didn't have a lot of experience, but from my the time that I spent in the United States Army Air Corps in the band, in the orchestra. And I always, you know, I learned how to play timpani, you know. And from that point, I always felt that drums,
why do they put these?
They wouldn't put the tension rods on there if they weren't supposed to be tuned or pitched. So I always thought that they're using more than one or two components of a drum set. That they should have at least a difference in tone quality from one drum to another, and it should be clear enough so that it could be very distinctive. And so that was my philosophy, if you will, of how the drums should sound. I think it should have a, you know, like a tone, just like a timpani. I know they're not timpani, but at least they can have a pitch that can be sustainable. Something that at least if it won't vary from it won't matter if it goes flat, or it won't matter if it goes if it's a little sharp, but because it's in within a certain range of sound that gives it the projection of that quality of a tone, and that's what I feel is necessary and essential in the makeup of the drum set. And so I made it a point, a business of my own to try to tune instrument as well as possible, I mean, at least in a relative pitch, so that each instrument would be, each component of the instrument would have a distinct tone and a sound. And I want to complete this. When my first experience with recording with, I think a great engineer, Rudy Van Gelder, and he made most of the recordings for Blue Note and Savoy, Prestige, and all these jazz. But he made his own microphones, you know, and he was actually a eye specialist. He's a doctor. Surgeon, and with this, so the recording was his hobby, because his father was a doctor. They had this office, and he recorded in his father's house in the basement because he made this studio. So, but he made these microphones, and he would just hang in the center of his room. And so nobody would be partitioned off like they do now. You just simply put the microphone in there, one microphone, and it would pick up the group, you know, five pieces or whatever, in a very effective. And that's how, and he had very little work to do as far as, you know, edit the tape or everything was done by tape at MLC, and he had to mix and edit. So he had very little to do because it was already mixed in as mono sound in the initial recording. So it always came out very good, and the quality was very high. So that was another thing that I really appreciate that. He picked up the drums so beautifully.
He asked if it could be possible to have some suggestion by you the way to keep the time, to keep the swing over the cymbal, and his request. Would be good to have any one of us playing, and you suggest. And I say that you are the chef of the of the clinic, and you are who you are. So I think that we appreciate everything you want to do.
Well, I think that's a very good idea. The thing is that that brings the clinic into the nature of a classroom. I'm not giving lessons. We're simply having a dialogue, basically about the philosophy of what the instrument is, what possibilities exist, and how, you know, at least some of the experiences that I've had, and with some of the people that I've worked with, from whom I have learned so much. And I think that illustration of on one to one on one, and giving the tips more or less that should be reserved for a private session, because learning that in that kind of is very sensitive. You know, people who have I don't know what stage of development anyone is. All I can do is say is that if you find yourself in, at any level, and it really doesn't matter which level, when you find yourself, then it's then you either you have a friend. Everybody has a friend that they talk to and they study with. Sometimes, you know, I know I did. I was, you know, I probably learned more from a friend of mine who was he didn't even want to play. He was the best drummer I ever saw in my life, and he cared. He could care less about music. He wanted to be, and he is a geological engineer. Go down in the ground and find oil or rocks or whatever. You know, that's all he wants to do. He's the best drummer I ever saw in my life. He could take a part. He listened to a recording. I said, Max. I said, well, now you're gonna watch this. This is what he's gonna do. And he told me it's all of the rudiments that he's playing, and now he's playing this sequence, and he turned the record player off, and he'd do it, you know, on a practice pad. I said, so it just made me feel sick, you know. He played like this, and he doesn't even want to play drums. So that was my, you know, that's why I sort of, I can show you in another way that what that means. Not by illustrating and demonstrating with someone who is not who may be shy, you know. People are, you know. I am myself.
I could ask questions all day, but I'm gonna try and put it all into this one. So I have a question about concepts that you deal with, and if there's some now that have changed, but I just read, I think I read, or I heard or something, I don't know if they're even valid, but about two concepts that you have dealt with in the past, and one is a concept of, like, painting, I guess. I don't know if that's something, it was a concept that I read, I think, about I don't know if you. I think the thing said maybe you close your eyes and you try to imagine the sounds as colors or something. And you know,
that was a documentary.
Oh yeah, okay. Maybe that's what I said. Okay.
A friend of mine made. You know, took us. You know, he was going to Columbia University in the cinematography.
Yeah.
And he took 5 years to do that. And eventually he got to a point where he got the grants, and he could get enough money to buy the film and rent the cameras but mostly he had all of his friends would help him. You know, he didn't have to, you know, they did it for nothing.
Yeah.
That was introduced as plastic heads. First, he started with Saul Goodman, who was a percussionist with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. And Saul, he gave him to experiment with the plastic heads for his timpani. And he came back, you know, he had actually made a world tour with the Philharmonic, and when he came back, he said that they played outside, they played inside. He said the head stayed, you know, with the consistency of the tension was always there. He said, I didn't have to worry about the moisture or any of that. So that's what began to make the plastic heads very popular, and it was most of the. Some Philharmonic percussionists began to use them, and it spread to the drum companies began to stock as basic stock when one would buy a set of drums, it would have plastic heads on it instead of cafe. So it sort of changed. It's sort of a very, very rapid change from one technology to another. Well, that's a sort of a history of this head, drumhead technology. But I still tend to recall when I used to do Art Blakey, and I first saw him do it, and I wanted to experiment myself with using a timpani head on a bass drum, you know, or at least on the front head of the bass drum, a plastic or a cap head on for the batter part of the drum. And that way, it eliminated most of the overtones or harmonics, I guess, what you call it. It gave a very clear sound, but the thing is very difficult to cut and tuck these timpani heads. It's a time consuming. You have to soak it for 3 or 4 days, and then you have to tuck, you know, cut the dimensions and then tuck it onto a wooden rim. And they began to start making metallic rims, aluminum rim, and you just could not tuck a cap head or a organic head onto a metal rim. It wouldn't stick, it wouldn't hold, it would just peel right off. You know, so.
When you talk about timpani, that's you mean calf timpani?
Calf timpani, yes. Well, I had to, you know, we were just epic. I have a bunch of them now. I still got them. They roll up in my house, and I'll never use them, I'm sure. But, because I don't have any wooden rims. That's the problem. You need to have a wooden rim to tuck a cat head. So it just doesn't work otherwise. Here we are. I think that the whole process of the development of a plastic head has improved a great deal. So it used to be very heavy and thick, you know. But now it's the texture is almost the same as an organic head, and they're much easier to handle. And if you can buy them, as many as you like in this store, you know, they'll last until you start to use them. They're perfectly new, you know, so they don't deteriorate in storage, and that's one great advantage of using plastic. Plastic heads, and they're already mounted, and all you have to do is take them off. So it's a very simple process to change. So we can stop talking about drum heads.
Okay. Tell us something about timbers, for example.
Oh, alright.
Yeah, the one because of the piano.
Right, as much as I first, from what I know about them, you know, they've been making cymbals for longer before I started to use them. for instance, the Zildjian cymbal company they've been making cymbals in the United States for 375 years.
Questi sono gli altri Zildjian, che sono 375 anni che vengono fatti in America.
And they're originated in Istanbul, Turkey. And that's where the Zildjian family originally, their origins were from Turkish, Armenian, I believe is the background. And they've been I don't know, maybe making symbols. He probably made symbols for Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan.
Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan.
Right. Yeah. So the history is vast, and it stretches back into the history of the world, in that sense. What I know is that when I began to my teacher, for instance, in the middle school, was a percussionist who studied percussion at the University of Michigan. So when he got his degrees and began to teach school, I was fortunate enough to be taught in the school that I went to, but maybe he made me a very lucky young man. And he's told me that he was involved in a project making a sound, a film soundtrack in Hollywood. And they needed a certain sound, a tone. They could only, they tried all kinds of ways. They went to the Zildjian Company and they got a block of metal. It's just a rectangular block of metal. And that was the sound that they needed for this orchestration and the soundtrack. And that's what so from that point, it made me very interested in the most important aspect of the symbol, which is the sound. And from that point on, I've always, I couldn't afford to have, I didn't have a symbol myself, you know. I used the symbols that belonged to the school. I used symbols that belonged to the army, you know, when I was in the army. And I used everybody's symbols but my own, because I didn't have any money. I couldn't buy anything. But when I finally got to the point where I could purchase them, when I bought a set of drums, I thought, the symbols that they used to give a set of symbols with a drum set if you paid for them, and then you get the drum cases, you get the high dollar stands, and they give you cases for the cymbal bags and all kinds of things. And of course, the cymbals were free, and the ones that I had were the Zildjians. They were K. Zildjians, I think, they're probably the best symbols that you could ever find. They were available at that particular time. And I would hit them constantly, you know, just bing. I didn't have rivets or anything. I just, when you strike a cymbal, it always, you hear a bing, it's like a wave, and a sound wave. And the way to get the most of the tone quality from a cymbal is to be able to hear the depth of that sound wave and be able to. So the vibrations have to work up to the point where the depth is shorter and shorter. So it just sort of allows you to accelerate the speed. You can play it as fast as you like, because the depth of that sound wave is always there, and that's what you. If you can hear that, you can play into the trowel, more or less, you know, into that groove. and that's where you get the best quality of the tone from. From his own.
How do you start to play the rhythms? On the, or why or how long?
The old K company used to make a very, very, what they call a paper thin cymbal, and it was generally 22 inches in the diameter, and it was very thin, and it had a sound similar to the last lingering sound of that rivet vibration on the rivet, and so I had one of those things, at least it wasn't belong to the army, you know what I mean? But I used it, and anyway, it was very fragile, and it broke, you know, it split, and I kept playing it anyway, and it seemed like the sound would get, it was better, you know. And the only thing that I, the closest thing that I could get to that, and I heard, of course, what they call a Chinese cymbal, which is sort of, it curves up. It's like a hat with a brim that curves up, and that has a sound similar to this as well. So rather than, I just didn't like the way. To carry a Chinese symbol, that means where are you going to put it? If it curved like that, it wouldn't fit. You know, the other symbols wouldn't fit on it. You know, so where am I going to put it then? So I thought, I'll just it's just easier to just drill some holes and use a symbol like that. And it got the same effect, the same tone that I was looking for. And of course, it varies with this happens to be eight rivets around the circumference of this. You can do it easily with six. Or even five, you know, it really doesn't matter. It depends on, these are what they call a 2-pound rivet. So the rivets are, in other words, a pound of them, and it's very light, but you get them in 2-pound bag, a bag that's, it weighs 2 pounds and is full of these rivets. That's why they call it 2-pound rivets. I don't know why, don't ask me why. But anyway, I got accustomed to this sound, and I know that I found that playing with sometimes we meet with trumpet players that muted, they mute the horn like Miles Davis used to do, and trumpet players like Dizzy Gillespie could use mutes and very effectively. This, for some reason, the rivet and the mute were a perfect match, you see. And so for that reason, I always kept at least one that I could. In case a trumpet player wanted to play with his mute, and I would say, okay, I'll change the cymbal, I'll play with my rivet cymbal. But it sounds, it's a subdued sound, it's not Yeah, nothing to do with the volume. It's just that it's a quality of the drum that I think it's easy to listen to when blended into an orchestra of woodwinds or brass or a combination of that. Sorry. The long speech of living on pressure on him.
Watt from Pedro's show, and you heard for most of the second hour there a question and answer session with the incredible drummer man Elvin Jones, March 11th, 2001, 10 years ago. And the man who was at that workshop in Ravenna, Italy, where it took place, was Andrea Belfi, as a more younger man. And right after we heard Elvin talk, we heard a prodge of Andrea's called Hobo Combo and them doing Stamping Ground, a tribute to Moondog. We're at the end of the second hour of the December 3rd, 2011 Watt from Pedro show. Hold tight for hour three. December 3rd, 2011. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro show. Watt from Pedro Show. Start off the third hour with a big old jam there. That's from the album, and that's The Story of Jazz. A tune called Nagoya One, which is probably like the first part of a gig there, Nagoya. This is from a live album. I've already played the second and third part from Nagoya. There's another disc with Kyoto and what's the other town? Hanamaki. We'll get to that in future shows, but that was Jim O'Rourke. Brother Jim O'Rourke with Mr. Akira Sakata. And they were joined by Chico Marachi, which is a rhythm section composed of Chris Corsano and Darren Gray. Righteous stuff. I got to do a gig once with Mr. Akira Sakata, Mr. Jim O'Rourke, and I kind of choked. Pikachu from Afriampo was on the drums, and yeah, I got scared. Oh, what a baka. Anyway, I saw last week a gig in Pedro here at the ballet school, and Todd Conge was playing, Todd Congelier, and so made me think of, I want to play a whole bunch of Todd Congelier music. Here he is.
My boy won't try any wrong thing. My girl won't catch any blues. My star won't start as a long day. My heart is gullible too. I won't change the patient. I won't brag a nation. I'll make them make the creation. Cause there is the nation. Keep the free from the street, treat them that way. Until they got nothing to do.
Thank you.
Much respect to Brother Todd. Check out recessrecords.com. His label's got lots of good stuff. We first heard him with Toys That Kill here with V-Chip Toys. No, V-Chip. Sorry. And then Battery Low after that from his Clown Sound solo album. Then we heard him with Underground Railroad to Candyland, a tune called That I Don't Know. But spelled Dunno. And finally, question mark, Stone at Heart. That's got Baby Jess singing. And yeah, he was kicking up much dust. And everybody there, Bon Bon played, and some cats from Indiana. Their name slips me, but it was a good time. Here's some stuff from Italy, speaking of Brother Andrea. Juan from Pedro's show, and from Terracina, Italy, Manlio and his trio Neo doing Good Morning from his new album, the incredible guitar man, Manlio. Big respect. And then Sagatti's got something new. That was called Propaganda Blows. Three of them are Italian. One guy is Solemn from, where is he from? Bay Area of California? I got to do the Hand of Man Band thing with him in Texas last year. That's coming out in March now, I've heard. John Dietrich and Tim Barnes also aboard. Wild record. Then we heard something from, this ain't from Italy. Her name's Sierra in Action. Kind of CIA acronym, huh? U2 Live, something at this festival out in the desert, Joshua Tree or something. And then finally, Living Room by The Forest via The Captain. So I know it's somewhere in the U.S., but I don't know exactly where. Sorry, but good stuff. Coming through town is Realization Orchestra, a friend of Heather Locke. So we'll play something from them and Heather.
for my bonsai lover will drive me to my lonesome grave. They'll bite the hand that feeds and spend all of money you have saved. From your heartstrings, weave silk garters, build their doghouse on your grave. Ragged clothes dropping from my body, and the wolf is growling round my door. But the man who stole my darling girl will feel the bite of my 44. Corn whiskey has wrecked my body, a false lure is blaring on my mind.
From Pedro Show, finishing up this edition was Realization by the Realization Orchestra. That's a buddy of Heather Lockie, who did a tune right after that, False Hearted Lover's Blues. Something live from her and her viola. Not a lot of spiel for me, because I felt so self-conscious in the first part, all that stumble talking. So, sorry about that. We'll have a good wrap. When I got somebody to bounce off, it's a little easier. And next week we'll be back with Brother Matt, and we'll hopefully have our guest, Nicole Panner, who's had an interesting, or is on an interesting journey through life. She'll get to talk about that. I'm going to go up to San Francisco and play these two Stooges gigs with everything I got. Get to see Richard fucking Bonnie, too. That's righteous. It's been the December 3rd, 2011, Watt from Pedro Show. Everybody. keep your powder dry.